This podcast is proudly brought to you by Adventure Professionals. www.adventureprofessionals.com.au.
For me, Mission Ridge and Brigade Hill, the whole Kokoda campaign, more people need to know about it. I know everyone knows someone who's trekked Kokoda, but to actually understand the stories of what these young guys did, it's harrowing what they went through.
They were staunch to the end, against odds uncounted, and they fell with their faces to the foe.
Welcome to the Kokoda Track Podcast, hosted by former soldier Glenn Azar. This is the place to hear stories from those who've trekked Kokoda and gain tips and knowledge about what to expect on the track or to relive your own amazing experiences. The Kokoda Track Podcast, keeping the spirit of Kokoda alive.
I recently posted on the Building Better Humans Project Instagram and Facebook page a picture of Nathan Whittington, who's a young bloke that I took to Kokoda a few years ago, I think 5-6 years ago from memory, and he's an amputee and he was a soldier at the time. And so taking him on the track and then putting that photo up and just saying, look, no one really complained about having sore ankles on that trip. And I was kind of being a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it was actually true. No one complained about having sore feet or blisters or when you've got a bloke with one leg walking the track beside you. And he was only a young bloke at the time, you know, early 20s. And so once I put that up, it actually got quite a bit of engagement, which wasn't the intention. And people messaging me who had previously talked about doing Kokoda and then were like, oh, you know, too old, too this, too overweight, haven't got time, knees are sore. And then they saw that and went, oh, okay, excuse aside, I'm going to do Kokoda. And so I reached out to Nathan, just said, mate, I'd love you to come on the show, and which he's done, obviously, and I'm about to play that for you. But look, inspiring young bloke, you know, doing Kokoda is hard for anyone. So don't listen to this chat and think, oh, okay, I can definitely do it. It's going to be easy. You can definitely do it, but you do need to prepare. He was certainly very fit when he did the trip and is still quite fit now. So I'm not putting this on to say, hey, it's an easy trip, but I'm putting it on to say, as tough as it is for people, there are blokes like this out there that have done it with one leg. And there are people that have got ailments of all sort and they're different ages that have done it, of course. But I just thought it'd be great to do a slightly or offer a slightly different perspective for those of you guys and girls wanting to go on Kokoda. So I'm going to play this potty for you with Nathan. And just a reminder that we are open. We are operating treks next year. I'm personally running March, April, so both ends of Anzac, July, and I think October at this stage. The October dates aren't out yet. Two more years for me that I'll personally be running Kokodas before I fully hand over to my other trek leaders. So, and they're great trek leaders, so you're not going to miss out. But if you do specifically want to come on the Kokoda with me, then you're going to need to do that before the end of 2024, which is heaps of time. You're not in a rush, but I just thought I'd let people know. I don't want to get to, you know, 2025 and people saying, oh, I really want to do it with you and now you're not doing it anymore. So I've given a two-year window. And it's the only reason I'm not doing it is business requirements, family requirements, and just wanting to spend a little bit more time. For those that don't know, I've got a son who's autistic and intellectually impaired. He's 18 now. He's mentally about 5. And I kind of want to travel with him a bit over the next few years and start to dedicate my life to some other things. That's the only reason I'm kind of looking at getting out of specifically operating them myself. The business will operate. I'll be in the back end. I'll be training all of our people up. But it's just that I won't personally be leading Kokodas after 2024. So that's kind of what that's about. But without further ado, let's hand over to the podcast with Nathan Whittington. He's a right leg amputee from just below the knee. And he trekked Kokoda. And I just thought it would be great to share his experiences. Mate, I'm going to roll straight in. I've just restarted doing the Kokoda Track podcast. And when I recently posted that photo of you over on the Building Better Humans project, I thought, because I always think about that, like no one complained about having sore feet when you're on a trip or when one of the other amputees have been on a trip, right? Whereas yeah. Every other trip, typically someone will complain about that, but people don't dare when you guys are on the trip. So I thought it's a cool perspective.
It is. It sort of puts people like in their place without it meaning to as well. Like I've had it a few times where, you know, whatever I've been doing for work and I'll be a bit sore and people, especially it's funny with the ones who don't know I'm missing a leg and they go, oh God, my feet hurt or I've got sore legs or they'll complain about like a little wound or something. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool.
So Tell me about, like, what year did we do Kokoda?
2015?
Was it that long ago?
14, yeah, because 14 I had a couple of surgeries. So I think it was mid to late 2015.
Yeah, right. So obviously because this is for the Kokoda Track podcast, I guess talk me through or talk people listening through the experience of Kokoda. One, the decision why you decided to do it, particularly as an amputee. You're in the military at the time, I know, but also what that whole experience was like for you.
So I think, yeah, like you said, so because I was in the military, a lot of it was just the, I think I just wanted to do it more as a physical test. Like ever since losing my leg up until sort of recently, I've always just done everything as physical as possible to try and prove that I have overcome my injury. And so I've seen that as a really good challenge, the physical aspect. But then now I found out that like my great grandfather served like over there as well. So there was that there to sort of, I suppose, you know, follow his footsteps to a certain degree. But then, and also it's the experience, it's Kokoda, like who doesn't want to do it? But, you know, leading into it, I was pretty nervous, trying to get legs made and all that sort of stuff as well. And yeah, I think like I was pretty nervous actually on the, I remember the truck ride in the back of that like open Unimog style vehicle and like the dust going everywhere. Couldn't get water in because every time I'd go to have a sip, it'd just fall out everywhere because of the road conditions. And I was like, oh, here we go. It's about to start. I'm going to start on the back foot, no pun intended, because I'm going to be dehydrated as hell. But that was good.
Before we get to Kokoda, correct me if I'm wrong, but I kind of remember at the time, because you were really fit and you were trying to, I remember us having a discussion, and we 7 years, a long time ago, but you were trying to get into the PT stream in the military, and doing Kokoda was a way of proving to them that you had the physical capacity still. And you were fit as hell, but, you know, you were trying to prove to the military that despite losing the leg, I can still do everything.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, you know, yeah, it's 90-something K worth of walking, but a lot of it too, because I was pretty stubborn as well when I got, even though I chose a porter, it was more for, you know, not to fall into the, like, river crossings and all that sort of stuff, but I wanted to carry a lot of my own stuff. And so that was to show for the PT side of stream that I could still do some form of load carry as well.
You chose a blade for your foot from memory.
Yeah, it was like a bit of a hybrid between like a blade and a walking foot. So
it looked
like a blade where like the curve in the foot was a lot lower, but then at the base it sort of had like a bit of a walking platform, so I could still jog, but have a bit more of a spring within the foot as well.
Yeah, because you're the only, I've taken 5 or 6 leg amputees across, all from the military, and you're the only one that used that sort of blade sort of foot. So everyone had, you know, more of the, just a traditional foot with the flexible ankle.
Yeah, so I was one of the first people, I think, in Australia to try that foot out as well. And I thought, oh, what better way than, because I wanted to use it in the military, two, four load marching, because I had to sort of, you know, move in between sessions of like jogging and all that sort of stuff. So I thought I might as well give it a crack on Kokoda.
So hopefully it didn't break. How old would you have been on Kokoda?
Like 23.
Yeah, so 20. You're only young. So yeah. Tell me about the experience then. So part of this show is always ask people about, you know, what the experience was like, compared to what they thought it was going to be. And obviously being a soldier, we have some better capacity to understand what a load carry up and down some hills is like. But for you, was it what you expected? How did it differ? Was it easier, harder? Like, what was your sort of overall sort of feel on it?
Overall, it was pretty much what I expected, except because we did it in like in the middle of the drought or something. So it was hot, and I struggled a lot in the heat. With a movement in my leg. So I think that aspect of it made it really, really tough. So like the walking up and down, the terrain is what I expected.
Yeah.
It was just the weather conditions, not what I expected. I I packed and I was just waiting for like torrential rain and, yeah. and all that sort of stuff, which we got like half an hour of it on the last day or something. So to go through in their drought, it was just ridiculous humidity. It was hot. You know, at one stage there, they were back burning as well.
Yes, I remember that.
And, you know, walking along, I'm like just got sweat pissing out of me. I had those cuts on my leg as well. And yeah, then I encountered them back burning. I'm like, oh, this is heinous.
That was right before we hit the halfway mark, yeah?
Yeah. Mm. So when we go through like the swamplands, which were just dry.
Yeah.
And then the first hill was where they were back burning. And I was like, this is just heinous. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm not getting shot at, so it's fine. And that's all I kept thinking to myself is, well, I'm not getting shot at. This is not life or death. Just put my head down and keep going.
What was like the best day for you and the toughest day, like on the track? Did you have a day that stands out or a moment or a thing that you thought, yeah, man, that was awesome?
I think the toughest day is when I remember lying down in the tent and he came over and asked how I was going and I pulled my liner off and I had those, it was like three massive cuts on the, just below my knee on my stump there.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to get airlifted out. I need to keep going. And I remember you were dressing them and you just put like the alcohol strips straight on it. I think that was just the toughest day because like it hit me, you know, okay, I am an amputee dealing with this. And I'm like, I think we're only a few days in and I'm thinking, okay, you're finishing this no matter what. You're not going to get carried. You're not going to get airlifted out. Just keep pushing, I think was the hardest day. I think the best day was our second last day where we got to have a swim.
Yeah.
Because we chose to walk longer that day to have, was it like not even 2 hours worth of walking the next day or something. So
yeah.
I just remember taking my leg, my liner off, and I just didn't care about anything. And I just hopped in the water and it just felt like all the weight had come off my shoulders because I knew it didn't matter how I was feeling, I was just going to finish the next day because it was only a couple of hours, considering I think it was like a 9 hour walk, 11 hours, 9 hours, 8 hours, and then we finished off on like a 2 hour walk or something.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that swim just was so refreshing as well.
That was at Goldie River. I remember that.
Yeah. And that's when it rained too. It almost was like, yeah, it was just perfect time for it to rain because everyone was just hot and knackered. And then, yeah, just hopping in that river and having a swim was just the best feeling.
What's really interesting about the weather, I actually remember that whole year was really dry. They had like a drought, yeah, literally, which is very unusual in New Guinea. And most of the time I'll say to people, June, July can be dry, but I can go over there June, July and get rained on every day too. Like, it's so unpredictable. But that whole year, every time we got a dry trip, you normally get smashed the next trip, and we didn't. All year it was just dry. And so you literally don't know what you're going to get in that place, which is kind of part of it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, one of the fun aspects of it is that, you know, and everyone that has told me that's been over to PNG, like, just you wait for the weather, it's going to rain on you. And, yeah, it was like 30 minutes the last day, and, yeah, it was crazy.
What do you reckon the difference might have been? Like, would it have created any extra stress with your stump? Because I know with the sock that normally holds your leg on, you've got to keep that fairly dry, don't you?
Yeah, I think it might have almost been a little bit, it's hard to say because then everything would have got wet. I think it would have made it a lot more uncomfortable rather than just putting up with heat and a bit of sweat. I kind of preferred it to be hot rather than just raining. Then I've got to deal with mud. And so having the harder surfaces actually made it easier to walk on rather than dealing with walking through, you know, mud. Like, I've dealt with stuff like when I was in the military, it was all just sand and it was really, really difficult for me to walk in. And so to deal with a nice hard flat surface for, you know, 90 something cables.
Did you do sub-1 after you had lost your leg?
Yeah, I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then,
so I did that in 2016. So it was after Kokoda.
Yeah, right.
So I knew I was looking at prepping for it. So that was another reason why doing Kokoda. I was like, well, if I can do this, I can do bloody sub-1, it should be fine.
Yeah. Mate, do you recall much about, I don't know if you're really aware of this, but of like how the locals responded to you? And because I know often with when I take amputees, they're quite a bit sort of blown away by it.
Yeah, and I think that was the first time I properly dealt, like, experienced that sort of stuff. Even, I think, when we flew into Port Moresby as well, and we were getting all of our stuff and putting it onto the bus, like, there was one guy there who was quite high. I think it was he was an above an amputee, but, you know, just sitting on the back of that ute near our bus as well and having him just, like, stare because of how blown away he was with seeing another amputee.
Yeah.
Walking around. And then, yeah, I just remember those, you know, going through the villages and just seeing, seeing the locals. It was pretty crazy. They were just, it was confronting, but it was also pretty cool. Like, to, you know, in one way, it's like, okay, well, I'm kind of giving these guys hope that, you know, there is better options out there. But then it was also confronting just having a whole village just coming up and just staring
at you. Yeah. Well, I know with the porters and stuff, they have a massive affiliation with the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel. Like, they love that whole history. So whenever we've had one, soldiers in general coming over, particularly in groups like Mates of Mates, but two, when we've had amputees, I think it kind of makes them feel more connected to the past, which is really interesting, to the stories they heard from their grandfathers and so on, which is, you know, your grandfather or great-grandfather fighting over there. They're growing up hearing those stories, and then they get to see guys like yourself actually out there doing something in that. I don't know, it's very surreal, that whole sort of feeling for us, but also for them.
Yeah, it definitely was. I remember the halfway point when we did the ceremony, and, you know, like a handful of Aussies belting out our national anthem, which probably sounded a bit tone deaf. And then, you know, those guys who were just singing in harmony. And that was one thing I really remember about the trip is, you know, we're military, we're at all through that time is, you know, we're sort of programmed to just like squash our emotions, just sort of feel nothing or whatever of it. And like, that was probably one of the most emotional trips I've been on. Like, I cried as soon as I started singing. I cried when I finished. There was points there through that walk where I just was like on an emotional edge. And so, yeah, it was a very grounding, eye-opening experience.
Yeah, I always tell people it's quite emotional. I took one of my best mates across with his whole family, his wife and his three kids, and he'd spent 9 years in the SAS. And so he was one of the toughest blokes, and him and his wife had been together since they were 14. And when we got up to do, and he's just stoic as, and when we got up on Brigade Hill, I got him to do the ode, and he broke down halfway through it, and he really struggled to try and finish it. And I didn't rescue him, I just kind of sat, and he got really annoyed with himself, because that's what we do as soldiers for crying. But he'd lost one of his best mates in Afghan, and he just said it brought all this emotion up. And his wife, and they've been together since I was 14, she said to me, I've literally never seen him cry. And he still talks to me today about it. Like, he's one of the toughest humans that I've ever met. But so when we all think that we can be tough, but that place, mate, I've done now 79 Kokodas. I still feel that way whenever I read that story to you guys up on Brigade Hill, when I listen to the boys, when I watch people go out and talk. It still gets you. So for people that haven't been, you know, they're going to experience that for sure. And the people that have been, they relive it. Like, at the start and the end of this podcast, I've got literal soundtrack of the boys singing their anthem. You know, and every time I listen to it, I still listen to the whole end of the podcast because I love listening to the boys sing.
Yeah, and like, you can, it's hard to describe it unless you can't really describe it. You just have to experience it. It's just one of those things in life that, yeah, you have to experience it. And I tell everyone, and still do, that, you know, if you're going to do Kokoda, you've got to get over there and do it.
I sort of, and not people outside the military won't get this reference so much, but I kind of equate it to Kapuka, as in I can go through Kapuka and then you can go through, I went through Kapuka in 1990, right? You can go through 20 years later, but our stories are still going to be similar. So we're tied together by a similar experience, and Kokoda's the same. You can talk to someone who did it 7 years ago, a year ago, well, not a year ago, currently with COVID, but and 20 years ago, and they've got similar stories, because I've been doing this for the better part of 20 years now. And yeah, and the stories don't change that much because we all have that very unique shared hardship experience. You might get some differences in what weather someone experienced versus the other, but ultimately people always talk about the boys, Brigade Hill, the villagers, just how everyone lives on the track and how that makes us come home. And I know you were quite young when you did it, but you know, I'll come home still after all these trips and go, we're kind of out of whack in Western society. You know, life out there is simple. It's there's, you know, three generations of family all spending time together. It's just a very, very different feel to the way we do things in Western society.
Definitely. And everyone's real humble and just appreciative of everything. Like at the end of it, where we're back at, where did we stay? The Crown,
yeah.
Yeah. I just had all this extra clothes that I purposely didn't wear, a little bit of money that I just gave straight to my porter, and he was, it's almost like he didn't want it at the same time of being just so, you know, thankful for me giving him some stuff. And, you know, to me, I was like, I'm never going to wear these clothes again. And
yeah, nothing, you know, gets wasted over there.
Exactly. And that's why I just grabbed everything, the money I had left over, and I thought, you know what, it's better for him to have it and then for me to it just sit in the cupboard or whatever it's going to do. So
they're really quite selfless as well, because I don't know if you remember Stafford. He's our front guy, young fella. Every year I buy him a new pair of boots. It's just kind of a thing we do. And one year he's got a certain, he likes blue and yellow Solomons for some reason. That's what he likes, the running shoe. So I bought him a new pair the last in 2019, which is when I last run trips. And we're out on the track and he hasn't got them on. And I said, oh, because he normally wears them. I said, why haven't you got your new shoes on? He said, I gave them to my dad. I said, oh, how come? He said, oh, because dad needed some boots. So rather than give his old ones, which we would in Western society absolutely do, mate, you can have my old ones if you want. No, he'll give away his new ones. If you want something or you need something, they'll give it to you, even if it's the only thing they've got. They'll go, here, if you want it, you can have it. That's the sort of, I know, I love that selflessness. And I always talk to people about the local boys and the port, you know, the porters, and it's good to hire a porter, just even if you don't really use them, just for the local economy, because it all goes back to them. But also, they're the best customer service of any organisation or business, and they don't even mean to be. It's just how they are.
Yeah, well, you know, they're carrying this stuff if you, like you said, if you choose to use them, and then you rock up to a campsite and everything's done.
Yeah, nothing's a problem for them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're still so thankful. And it's like, you've done the work. We're saying thank you to you, not, it shouldn't be the other way around. Like,
mate, a lot more people would not make the track if not for the boys. There's no doubt about that. I've been out there in pouring rain, and it might start raining at 9 or 10 o'clock at night and bucket down like hardcore, and I'll get up and all the boys will be up and they'll be out in the rain digging little moats around people's tents, checking that they're all, like, while people are inside sleeping. It doesn't matter to them. That's just what they do.
Yeah, it was like, I'm trying to think back now, but we had a break and it was just at that bit where a lot of guys run. It was about 3 or 5K of up.
And yeah.
Really high through routes.
That's the Imina Ridge.
That's it. And I remember looking at some of these, you know, step ups basically, and I'm like, this is ridiculous here. And then there's a photo someone's taken, which was, it was my Facebook profile picture for ages. And I was so tired. My leg was hurting. And especially my left leg, because I was just loading that up, because obviously my right side is the one that's missing.
Yeah.
I had to step up on one, and I almost felt like I was struggling. And it's out of nowhere, this hand just come up from under my arm and just, helped me up.
I actually took that photo.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, I took 3 or 4 photos because it was blowing me away, the size of the steps. And I was thinking that, you know, you've just got one quad really doing all that work, because that was the one they had to keep taking the big steps. And then I think I got the photo of you doing the step up, and that was maybe one of the ones I shared. But it was from that series anyway. And then there was also one of the boys is there, and that's what they're like.
Yeah, and it just helped. I remember just saying thank you, and he was like, that's all good. I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, this guy has no idea how much he just saved me from going ass up just then.
I remember, I don't know if you remember this incident, but we were coming down into Minari, which is our halfway point, just before we get to the service, where we stay the night before. And so we're coming down there, and you had those, you know, blisters or cuts on your stump, and you were saying to me, I'm going to have to take my leg off and just, I'll just hop around camp and just, I need to air it out. And when we get into camp, and then you rolled your ankle as we're coming down that hill. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And so when you took your boot off, it swelled up. So now your one good leg has got this swollen ankle. And that's when you said to me, I have to finish it because, you know, I'm trying to prove a point here of what I'm capable of doing, obviously. And I said to you, look, because I wake everyone up at 5 for people listening when I run a trip, wake them up at 5, step off at 6. So I said to you, mate, I'll come in a bit early, like 4:30, wake you up and I'll strap your ankle. And I got to you at 4:30 and you had already strapped your own ankle. And that just, I use that story regularly to talk to people about mindset. If you want to get something done, you'll get it done. Like you were never going to allow yourself to be a liability or to be flown out. And so, and luckily, because that's when we did Brigade Hill next. And but that's the sort of mindset, I guess, maybe it's as soldiers in particular that we carry. But yeah, that's an incident that always stuck out in my mind. I tell, whenever I'm on Kokoda, I tell people about that.
Because that's right. Because that's the night where everyone was sitting around having dinner. And I was like, I can't move. I can't put a leg on. I just need to rest it. Obviously, my left, I just done my left ankle.
Yeah.
I was willing just to stay in the tent.
Eat. The boys carried you over, didn't they? Some of the other, some of the other soldiers.
Yeah, and then I just remember them yelling out like Nathan. And I opened my tent, and there they were. They just picked me up and carried me over. And I just sat there, and I was like, "That's pretty cool."
Yeah.
But, yeah. That was another thing too. That I think, you know, we always talk about the camaraderie that we experienced within the defense, but I don't know, stuff like that. Like, I've never been deployed, but you know. Stuff like that is like probably the most genuine, just so rich camaraderie that I've ever felt. Which, you know, I'm assuming, you know, people that have been deployed, that's what they feel like. You know, we're there for everyone.
You, now it's like 7 years on. Like, you know, what is, do you ever think back on Kokoda? Is it just pop in your head randomly like it does for some people?
Yeah, every now and again, I'll just, you know, I just think about it. I got a few mates now, you know, non-military mates who are really wanting to do it. And they always ask me how it was and what they should do. And I'm like, you know, I always tell them everything I experienced with doing it. And I said, you know, I'd love to do it again. I'd love to go the other way. But you haven't any doubt. I think when I'm doing something physically hard, I try and think back to it. I'm like, well, if I can do that, I can do, you know, this workout or this row or whatever it might be. But, yeah, sometimes I'll just see photos or memories pop up and it just sort of sits me back a little bit and I just start to think about it.
It's funny you should say that, how, you know, you can tie into that as to allow you to do other things because, and obviously you were quite a physical guy anyway, but I take regularly sort of, say, 40, 50-year-old mums, couple of kids, haven't probably exercised for a while, you know, blokes that work in offices, sitting down in front of computers all day, all those sort of people. And they train up for, you know, 12 weeks or 3 months, up to 6 months, get themselves ready. But it's a struggle. It's a struggle all the way because they haven't got our backgrounds. They haven't been doing this stuff for years. They're not used to carrying backpacks. And I watched the first 2 or 3 days where there's kind of doubt. I don't know if you went through this, but kind of, geez, can I make this? Because the hills are a bit steeper than you realise. And then I see the back end of it where they start to realise, oh, I'm going to make this. Like, I'm going to be all right. And always, eventually, they'll talk about, well, if I can do this, I wonder what else I can do. Yeah. And this is people in their 40s and 50s learning these lessons, which I think is a pretty cool thing.
I experienced that 100%. When I first started with the heat, I'd already started to swell my leg after the truck ride into our starting point. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be a lot harder than I thought here.
Yeah.
And then same thing, you know, as I went on, I'm like, I just counted down the days and all that sort of stuff just to make, you know, small goals, just make it a bit more achievable. But definitely once I finished, I'm like, oh, if I can do that, what else can I do? And I remember at the airport when we flew back into Australia, you asked if I was keen to do some more, some hikes and all that sort of stuff. And I said, definitely. Yeah. Now I love it. Like, even, you know, nothing obviously of Kokoda size, but, you know, just taking the dogs for a walk. And if any way I can go, you know, into the bush or just go off a normal path, I will.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's good. It definitely, it's crazy what it does for someone's mindset. Like it just
just being in nature, I think we need it.
Just everything else, just look, it doesn't matter. Just puts everything in perspective.
If you had your time again, is there anything you would do differently, you know, as far as anything from preparation to what you took on the track to what you wish? Is there anything you wish you didn't take, or is there anything you wish you did take?
Yeah, I wish I didn't. I took a lot of, like, because of the weather, I took a lot of socks and jocks.
Yeah.
I wish I didn't take so many socks and jocks. Yeah. But those walking poles, I didn't take them. I think it was the Kirby. Yeah. I broke his. And from then on, I was like, was it the Stairway to Heaven?
Yeah. Yeah, the Golden Stairs.
That's it. I borrowed his at about that mark because I was in a lot of pain because my leg really started hurt going downhill.
Yeah.
Not so much uphill because I couldn't use the spring in the leg.
Mm.
And so when I borrowed his walking poles, I remember from then on, I was like, I wish I had brought these.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing I tell people. I'm like, if you're going to do it, buy walking poles.
Yeah. I actually agree. And, I get people that I just use one, some people use two. But I get some people that won't use one because they think it's kind of, I know it's a cheat or it's a weakness. And I know for me, like I'm 50 and I just know that, you know, after a 17-year military career, my knees aren't always as good as they could or should be. Some trips are really good and other trips are just, and always the same, that downhill just gives you curry. And I remember reading a study years ago that said with the trekking poles that they take about 5 pounds of knee strike pressure off for every step that you take. And I'd imagine that'd be more significant for you because you're putting a lot of predominant weight on that left for one, and then your stump's taking all that pressure on the way down on the other side because you can't avoid it the way you can on the uphill. So yeah, I always advise for trekking poles, and you can get cheap ones, but they're typically not cheap like most things in trekking. But walking poles and boots are the two things I say don't scrimp on. Like if you're going to do it, you know, those are your feet being on the ground all the time and having the capacity to take some pressure off your knees or, you know, in your case, your stump is going to be super helpful. Everything else you can get by without, you know, having the best of everything. But those two things you don't want to scrimp on.
No, definitely. Yeah, I was lucky I spent a fair bit of money on shoes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, as soon as I started, I just regretted not buying those walking poles.
When you decided to do it, was there anyone in the military saying, what are you doing? Like back at your unit or anything like that, or were they all supportive?
No, I had, so 12 months before this, I had another mate. So I was posted a bit of backstory, post RMC, which was the closest unit to my family and for rehab and all that sort of stuff. When I was there, I had another mate who was posted there. He ended up getting a tumor just behind his collarbone from deployment. And so 12 months before I got asked to do Kokoda, he did Kokoda.
Right.
He loved it. And from then on, I was like, I want to do this. And so when we found out, well, when I got asked, I just, everyone, you know, just nothing but support. And I went to him for everything. And yeah, even he was saying, like, you know, it's going to be the best experience of your life.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So, yeah, I did not encounter any form of negativity of what are you doing? Why would you do that? It was either I'm jealous, I want to do it, and all good luck.
Yeah, that's awesome. What's the future hold for you? Have you thought about doing any overseas treks, your Kilimanjaros, your Everest base camps, or is there anything out there that kind of tickles your fancy?
I definitely would like to do it again. Pretty much anything really that, you know, I get offered to go over and do anything, I'll have a crack. I think, you know, personally, I'm not really sure, like my partner and I are looking at planning to go to New Zealand at the start of next year. So
yeah.
She's asked, what do you want to do? And I just said, I don't want to go near a city. I just want to go outside and experience the views that New Zealand has to offer. So, you know, do a bit of Milford Sound and all that sort of stuff. But, I don't know. I think, you know, just Everest Base Camp would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's stuff, just big stuff like that, just on my bucket list, I think. But, you know, it's just obviously finding time and a good group of people who want to do it as well.
That's an experience, Everest Base Camp. Like, I like a lot of trips. I love Everest Base Camp purely because the absolute majestic nature of those mountains. Like, you realise how tiny we are when you're surrounded by 8,000-metre peaks. Kili I like because it's a tough climb. Africa is just a beautiful place. PNG, Kokoda, I don't think you can beat it as an Australian for the physical, mental and emotional journey. I think it just ticks boxes that, as good as those other things are, they don't quite tick. And maybe not for everyone, but certainly for Aussies because of our history there. And when that's done well, and it's more than just a trek, I just think it just stands alone as far. But those others, it's just the actual scenery and the majestic nature of sitting in amongst these massive mountains. You know, the first sort of 2 or 3 days on Everest Base Camp, you see these 6,000 metre peaks, which in Australia is pretty big. And you look around and you think, wow, and the locals are kind of like that. And then you get up above 4,000 metres and you're seeing the 7,000, 8,000 as you go, okay, now I get it.
I think 100% agree with the way how you just describe Kokoda, but I think a lot of it has to do with who takes you. Like, you know, there's always going to be the physical aspect of Kokoda or doing a trek that long, but, you know, one thing I do tell people is how well delivered the whole trek was from yourself.
Yeah.
I say this to everyone. I was like, you know, I remember that where we had our ceremony on Brigade Hill, the stories that you read, I was like, if you're going to do it, you need to find someone who is either ex-military or somebody's just genuinely passionate about military history. Otherwise, you're just not going to get the same experience. You get the physical aspect, but I think with how you delivered it, you delivered the emotional aspect of all as well, which I think made Kokoda even more special than, all right, we're just going to walk for 11 hours today and
we'll
stop here for food and here for, you know, camp at the end of the night. It was the stops. It's the, you know, the little bits where we pulled off to the side of the track and all those, you know.
Talked about things and
stuff and like, all right, up there is this or like, yeah, I think, you know, there's probably not like you being an ex-soldier as well, just don't give yourself enough credit of how special you made that trip for everyone on our group.
It's funny you should mention that because there are a couple of companies that are really good at that. Because I observe everyone, I get on with most people over there, I know most people, but there are definitely some that just don't do it. And it's none of my business, but it disappoints me a little bit because I just think there's 20 people or whatever on that trip that don't know what they've missed out on. They don't know the depth that you can take people on the story, and that's our role. Otherwise, because I did a trip... I remember I was up on Brigade Hill. I did the Brigade Hill thing once and we were just finishing and another group was coming the other way. And this guy came up and said, what are you guys doing? And I said, oh, we're just doing a service. You know, we just finished a service. And he goes, yeah, but what's it for? And I said, well, this is Brigade Hill. And I explained what Brigade Hill was. He goes, yeah, but like, is this a special trek or something? I said, no, it's just, I do this on all my treks. And he said, oh, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing? And he said, we haven't done any military history. And I said, oh, have you got an Australian guide? Because some companies don't have an Australian guide, which is fair enough. And he said, yeah, that's, people do that for budgetary reasons, I guess. And he said, yeah, we've got an Australian guide. And I said, well, what's he do? And he said, well, he just kind of tells us where we're going each morning and, you know, and where we're going to put our stops in, and that's kind of it. I think it's almost a waste of having that guy there because and you don't have to be a soldier, although I'm not going to lie, it helps. But I think if you're going to trek lead, and I'm looking at training people to trek lead now because I'm going to stop doing Kokoda over the next, in 2 years' time, to focus on some other things with my son. And so I've given people a 2-year window of me personally taking them, but I want them to start training other people up because for me, I want the history of Kokoda to stay alive. So even I've got a couple of trek leaders who are non-soldiers, but they're so passionate about the history that they tell it really well. Obviously the difference for me is I did spend 17 years in and I can talk about, you know, deployments and people go, oh, why did they do that tactically? And you go, well, look, I wasn't on the ground in 1942, of course, but this is why I would think they would do that. Yeah. And that's all we can do. And so, yeah, I just feel like people miss out a little bit, but they don't even know it. And I'm sure they still have a great trip. It's the locals, it's the terrain, it's hard walking, it's the weather. They get all of that, but they're just missing that little piece that I think makes a massive difference. And obviously when I do soldiers groups like yourselves, I really go above and beyond with that because to me that's the connection for us as soldiers ourselves. We get to connect to right back to the 1940s and where we came from and the history that we're a part of. And it doesn't matter, deployed, undeployed, it doesn't matter. We all serve and we're all connected to that history somewhere. And I think if I didn't do that, I would just feel like I'd done a disservice to you guys.
And it helps get through the track as well. Like there were some of those stories that they were saying, you know, there was a guy that was missing his legs and he just started to leopard crawl through the jungle just to get back to...
Yeah, John Metzen, he got shot through the ankles.
That's it. Yeah. And so I was hurting through one leg and I just started imagining that, and it's crazy what your mind does when you start to think of those stories and you're like, well, I'm not getting shot at, but, you know, here I am just imagining a guy leopard crawling, you know, through PNG just to get back where he needs to go. Or, you know, at certain little stops, like Brigade Hill, where you said, you know, the US, was it like 11 Ks either side, we're just going to bomb it to field everyone up.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to, like you said, be deployed or have a tactical mind, but you can literally just stand there and imagine that, especially when you're saying with the old mate with a pitchfork, he was just stabbing guys, like stuff like that. Like you can just imagining it and going like, well, this is crazy. Like it was weird, it's how emotional and just the mental aspect of you know, someone who can actually be genuine in telling the stories about Kiko. You know, it just makes it so much better.
Do you know what it is too? Like even for you, obviously, being an amputee, it was different again. But for most of us, if you're walking the track and you're hearing those stories and if you're really struggling, you can push through. But you can also say to yourself, worst case scenario, there is an airlift available. That didn't exist in 1942. That didn't exist during the middle of the war. So even if they needed to get out, they're on a stretcher and being carried for 4 or 5 days to get to the end of the track, which I'd imagine sitting on it, we've all been on stretchers in stretcher carriers before as soldiers, you know, in PT or whatever. Imagine being carried up and down those hills whilst injured on a stretcher. It would be the worst experience.
And that's, I'm not going to lie, a little part of me did think that, you know, worst case, we'll get you stretchered here and do this. I'm like, I can't think of anything worse. I was going to be so uncomfortable. I'll just walk it out. I'll walk it off. Don't worry about it.
Mate, advice that you would give other people who are looking at going, and obviously people ask you all the time, what do you sort of tell them?
It's hard because usually the first thing I ask is what their fitness level's like. You know, it's quite a physical demanding, you know, walk that, you know, I just tell people to start training, just work in your cardiovascular fitness and don't be afraid to wear those boots in because you don't want to do that with new boots. But I don't really give too much mental advice because people ask, you know, how did you push through? What did you think about? And I'm like, well, not quitting is a big one. Like it just works for me and everyone's a little bit different. And I'm, you know, apart from telling people to work on their physical advice, physical self, and next thing I say is get yourself a good trek leader. Enable you to connect to the whole thing emotionally. Otherwise, you'll be tired, but it's going to be a waste.
Yeah. Mate, that's awesome. I'll sort of wrap us up there, but I just found those photos of you the other day and I put them on the Building Better Humans Project site. And a lot of people messaged me going, man, that makes me want to do Kokoda because a lot of people give me excuses. Like, I've always wanted to do it, but, you know, I'm 40 or I'm 50 or I'm insert whatever the thing is here or my knees are sore, I'm overweight. And then I put that photo up and I had four. And I didn't mean it. I didn't put it on the Adventure Professionals page. I wasn't trying to sell anything. It was just the Building Better Humans Project page is about trying to help people be better humans, of course. And so I put that up because I liked it. And I had like four or five people mention me going, all right, I'm going to do it now because I've been having excuses. And then I look at that and I go, okay, I don't really have an excuse. So, mate, even now, you don't realise it, but you're affecting other people in a positive way that you don't even know that you've never met, which I personally think is a pretty cool thing. So as soon as I put that up, I thought, I've got to ring him and or message you and see if you want to be on and just have a chat about it. So, mate, thanks for coming on.
Nah, thank you. Like I've always said, yeah, it's an absolute bloody honour to be on one of your podcasts. So I'm stoked.
Yeah, you're a weapon, mate. I reckon we've got to do it again.
Yeah, definitely.
Let the sin of our joys to be free. Praising God, there'll be joy seen to be. Papua New Guinea.
The bond between Aussies and the people of Papua New Guinea was forged in war, and it endures in peace. We've felt that friendliness, that special connection, in the comforting presence of our porters and in every small community along the Kokoda Track. Papua New Guinea, we are independent, we are free. Papua New Guinea.
guys, thanks for tuning in. It would be awesome if you'd share this with anyone you know that's going to the Kokoda track or that has been and has a keen interest in the track, its people, and those that choose to trek it. The pillars of Isharava say courage, endurance, mateship, and sacrifice. Great words to live by, and this podcast will offer mateship and a place for those that live and love the Kokoda track experience. Until next episode, live a life that inspires you and those around you, and remember to take time out to think about what's really important. What's really important. What's really important.
Thanks for listening to the Kokoda Track Podcast. To get in touch or stay up to date, go to Kokoda Track Podcast on Facebook or email Glenn at adventureprofessionals.com.au. Don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. Let's keep the spirit and the stories of Kokoda and the PNG people alive.